Today's episode of the Sidious Mag Podcast on the Sidious Mag Podcast Network is brought to you by Goodert Sunglasses. It's the summertime. If you're out for a run or on the beach, you got to take care of those eyes and put some shades on. I've been rocking Goodert Sunglasses all summer. I've got all my friends wearing them because they're light, they don't slip, they don't bounce, they don't fog up. And the best part about them is that they are super affordable and start at just $25 a pair. So why break the bank for a pair of $250 sunglasses that you might lose or break? You can get like five pairs for half the price and then mix and match them to your outfits. My favorite part about Goodert Sunglasses is the name that they assign to all the different shades. And if you go to goodert.com/sidious, you can check out some of my favorites. I recently updated that list to include some new ones that I've been rocking. There's two pairs of their Superfly style. One of them is called Dirk's Inflation Station, and the other one is called Shaves Legs, Grows Beard. They have the origin stories behind the names on the site, so go and check them out. Goodert is generously offering our listeners nothing. Absolutely nothing at all, because there's no discount needed when they're already the most affordable performance shades out there. Go to goodert.com/sidious. That's goodr.com/sidious. Check out my favorites, snag a pair, tag me in your photos. Look good, run Goodert, legs are feeling good, eyes are looking gooder. My guest for today's show is Eidos Ibadin. I had seen him in an Under Armour commercial and a photo shoot last year, but I didn't really know too much about him. He's a pro runner with the District Track Club in Washington, D.C., and I decided to get him on the show after he went viral over the weekend with a pretty cool tweet that said, "Dang, I really ran 144 on Friday." This is the same guy who never made an NCAA final, only made NCAA in the 800 one time, only had one scholarship offer out of high school, wasn't All-American in high school. Where your story starts isn't where it ends. And I thought that was just awesome. So I wanted to know a little bit more to his story and how he's gotten to this point, plus what it was like to run at an HBCU. So without further ado, here is Eidos. All right, now we welcome on Eidos. Eidos, this past weekend I saw your tweets coming up, kind of went a little viral within the track and field world. So we'll start kind of like with the most recent thing, and it's the fact that you surprised yourself by running 144 this past Friday. How did that come together? Was that just like a time trial, or how big of a surprise was this?
Yeah, it was a time trial that we ran amongst my track group, District Track Club, and it was a little surprise just because I knew I was in good shape and I knew that I was able to run under 146. I was expecting to maybe run about 145, but when I came through 600 and coach yelled at 117 low, I knew I was okay. I can run something really fast here as long as I'm able to keep my form together and just finish strong down the home stretch.
Yeah, so the way you tweeted it out was, "Dang, I really ran 144 on Friday. This is the same guy who never made an NCAA final, only made it to NCAAs in the 800 one time, only had one scholarship offer out of high school, wasn't an All-American in high school. Where your story starts isn't where it ends." So you kind of outlined, I guess, for me, the perfect way to go about this podcast and share some of your story. But I want to go beyond that and even way before. Growing up in Prince George County, Maryland, I believe it's Kevin Durant territory. And I think at some point during the quarantine, there was even a basketball documentary that I think I just happened to be watching at some point. So I know a little bit of the basketball background, but what was it like for you to grow up in that area? And also, what was your introduction to running?
In PG County, basketball is very, very popular. Either you play basketball or football primarily, and I was neither. I didn't play basketball or football growing up, and I oftentimes thought, "Dang, am I really an athlete?" Because I grew up playing soccer, and I remember being in elementary school being afraid to tell people that I played soccer because everyone played football and basketball, and those were like the boys' sports that everybody played, and I just wasn't good at those sports. And I always kind of had a joy for running just in general. When I was a kid, I used to run around the house a lot, and I didn't pick up running until I was in 10th grade. And when I did, I picked it up and never looked back. And luckily, the coach I had at the time believed in me, and he said I can be really good in the sport, and so I just took that and ran with it.
So they introduced you to track, but then how specifically did you get into the 800 meters? Because, you know, I've talked about this with Dwayne Solomon a little bit, where there's that inclination, usually when there's flashes of speed, to throw someone, especially now that we're having these conversations about race, black track and field athletes, to find the middle distance and even the distances, it's not too, too common.
Right. So for me, when I first started running, I probably ran maybe about two races. So I joined the team, and then that week we had a race. And so just coaches threw me in the 300 indoors, did okay. Then I ran a 4x2 indoors, did a decent in that. And then after that, my coaches, I have the perfect race for you. So I'm like, all right, what's that? And he was like, 800. And I was just like, wait, what? You want me to do what now? And so he didn't necessarily throw me in the open eight, but he definitely snuck me in a couple 4x8s here and there. Then later in the season, I started doing open 800s.
And did you like it?
At first, no, I didn't like it at first. I hated it. And it eventually grew on me, maybe by like that outdoor season, it kind of grew on me a little bit because I saw like the potential that I had. And obviously he was the coach. And so I believed and trusted in his training plan. And I knew that he knew what he was doing at the end of the day.
So when you, over the weekend, you also started tweeting out, I think, some of your progression, and specifically with the 400, it goes back to 2009 when you ran 53.4, and now you've gone down in a decade to 46.67. So that 53.4, was that at that point, like when you were in high school?
Yeah. So 2009 was my first track season ever. And I ran 205 and 800 and 53.4 in the 400. And I think between the 2009 and 2010 season, it was definitely like a big drop. And people were asking me, so how did you make that big of a drop? And I told people that I wasn't really sure of like what I actually did. It was just the fact that I just had more experience in the sport, and that's what led to the big drop, in my opinion. And also, I ran cross country. So I came into the track season completely out of shape in 2009. So at least when I came in the 2010 season, I came in to have somewhat of a base build up just because of cross country.
What'd you make of cross country season? Because even when I talk to milers, cross country is that season where they're just pushing it way too long. So for an 800 guy, it must feel like eternity.
Man, I was terrible at cross country in high school. I was terrible at it in college. My best, these people are going to be surprised when they hear this, but my best cross country time in high school was only 18 flat.
For the 5K?
Yeah.
What courses were this? This is in Maryland, right? So you guys run some tough courses out there too, right?
Yeah, our courses were pretty rough, especially the state meet. That was awful.
And then kind of like as high school went on, because in that tweet, you said you didn't really get too many scholarship offers coming out of high school. Was your focus to keep this thing going, or like, well, why did you want to run in college?
So this is the crazy part. I actually had no intentions of running in college until maybe about my senior year of high school. Initially, I was afraid to run in college because I heard how hard it was. And so my junior year, I was like, okay, I'll just do this through high school, and then it's whatever. But then there was a guy who, he graduated before me, and his PR was my PR my junior year. So his PR was like 156, and he got a full scholarship to Howard. So I'm like, hold up. I just ran 156 as well. So if he can get a scholarship, I can get a scholarship. And so that's pretty much what led me to motivate me to want to run in college my senior year.
Sort of like, I don't know too much of your personal background, but to get a scholarship to go and pursue athletics in college, was that a big deal for your family?
It was. So growing up my parents are from Nigeria, and for those who know, Nigerians are very big on academics, and going to college for athletics isn't really heard of in our community, and it really isn't a huge thing. People don't know that you can actually get it. So like, I remember growing up, my parents used to think like you had to be next to LeBron James to get an athletic scholarship, and seeing me do that kind of opened their eyes a little bit, saying like, hey, like if he just got a full ride scholarship, we don't have to pay for a school because he was able to run, then, you know, it can definitely inspire someone else in our community to do the same as well.
Yeah, so the decision to choose Hampton, how did that come about?
Yeah, so initially, my PR was 155, and this was like late April, like not late, like mid-April, like right before Penn Relays, and I knew that like time was dwindling down, and I knew like, all right, I have to sign somewhere or else a lot of coaches are going to run out of money. Initially, I didn't want to go to an HBCU primarily because growing up in Prince George's County, a lot of kids are already Black. And so I kind of wanted a little bit more diversity in college. And I visited George Mason, but they didn't quite offer me a full, they didn't offer me a scholarship at the time because they wanted me to like retake my SAT and or something like that. And then a week later, that's when Hampton had offered me. And so I was like, okay, let me put this into consideration and see what happens from there. My high school coaches at the time, they were all for it. They wanted me to sign. And so I was just like, I don't know. I don't know how much time I have left. They only gave me 2 weeks to sign it. Like the coach really was quick with this, sending the letter of intent over to my house. Like he did like an overnight express mail type of thing. And I was just like, wait, I wasn't ready to sign anything yet. And because I didn't even visit the school either. So I was just like, dang. And that was the only scholarship offer I had at the time. And so I ended up signing with them in May. And then right after I signed, I went from 155 to 153. So I was like, well, I already signed now, so it's too late.
Did any other doors open up?
Mm-mm. Nothing else opened up. Primarily because I probably stopped looking, but yeah, nothing else opened up after that.
Did you feel like you were taking a risk on yourself a little bit?
I felt like I was, primarily because Hampton is definitely more of a sprint school than an 800 and up school. And going there, like I saw the school records at the time were like 151 outdoors and 153 indoors. And so I knew it was somewhat of a risk, but I also knew that since they're more of a sprint program, they were going to train me more 4.8 than 8.15, like I hear that most colleges programs do.
But, you know, hearing from about just like the way that they shipped that letter and they really wanted you to sign, it must have felt good to at least like feel really, really wanted by a program. Did that carry over when you arrived on campus?
For sure, yeah. So like my first conversation with the coach on the phone was like, he usually recruits based off of word of mouth. He doesn't really like act. He was an older man, so he doesn't really like actively recruit. But he was just like, yeah, who we want is you and really want you to come. And I definitely did feel wanted. And that was really the only coach who took a chance on me. And I'll thank him for that forever. And luckily at the time, also when I got there, our recruiting class that year was just insane. And looking back, I know I made the right decision because some of my teammates there are like friends for life now. And we did really well in college and like we were able to make NCAAs and relays and all that good stuff as well. So I definitely felt wanted when I was there and part of a good team and needed on a team.
Occasionally, I guess like I've been to, you know, a couple of meets, maybe like Penn State or a couple at, you know, the Armory, where there are these like historically Black colleges that are competing there. But everyone hears, you know, about HEPS and just like the unity that league has when it comes to the conference championship. What is it like for the historically Black colleges?
Man, it's amazing. Like we all just come together and we're all just running to compete against each other. And then also, even though we're all opponents on the track, like when we see each other like NCAAs and regionals, we're all still cheering each other on. And even like when we were at bigger meets like Florida relays, Penn relays, Texas relays, you know, the coaches will all, you know, share their own respects to us and stuff like that. And so we're all really, yes, we're opponents and during conference, but I think we all definitely root for each other on the track at different bigger meets and stuff.
What are sort of like the conversations taking place like right now among like alums from those schools, given like the political climate and like the social climate that we're in right now? Because, you know, I was thinking not too long ago about, you know, some of these top basketball prospects. So you hear so much about them and like how some are considering like, oh, you know what? I might take a closer look at attending a historically Black college and, you know, maybe elevating a program like that onto the national stage. But within track and the community that you're a part of, like, are there conversations like that taking place?
I think there's a few here and there. I think a lot of with track is definitely a lot different than like your basketball and football, because with track, you're always going to be able to compete against those mid-major schools, those Power 5 schools, or no matter what school you're at. And I think that seeing, like, for example, North Carolina A&T, they're HBCU, and they are doing phenomenally well in the NCAA. And so seeing that is going to get a lot of kids to want to go to those schools. And then also seeing some of the alum that came from HBCUs, like Kelly Wells and Francine McCrory, those are going to draw some other athletes to HBCUs as well, saying like, oh, if I can go to HBCU and still make an Olympic team and all that stuff, I can still achieve my Olympic dream, all while still being amongst the Black community. And so I think conversations like that are being had. And I think that a lot of people are definitely considering HBCUs more now than ever, especially in the track where it was already kind of popular to go to HBCU. And then now it's more than ever. It's definitely a thing now.
Who'd you look up to when you were growing up?
The person I looked up to growing up, a lot of people don't know this, but I never really had like an 800 meter runner I looked up to. The person I looked up to a lot was Tyson Gay, primarily because I like the way he finished his races. He had a good start, but his start wasn't always the best. And so seeing him close strong in those races really inspired me a lot. And then also he was like one of the few American athletes to beat Usain Bolt early on, even after like he broke the world record and all that stuff. So he used to be my screensaver on my laptop back in high school.
You've probably crossed paths with him at like a USA's, right, in the past couple of years, especially at the trials too, right?
Yeah, I've seen him at a couple of trials, and I've seen him like at Florida relays and all that stuff. I've definitely was always awestruck when I seen him.
What's like the first time that you felt that you were like on a big stage for the 800 in particular, like a race that took you a second to realize, like, man, like I can't believe like I'm up against these other guys.
Probably NCAA regionals, primarily because I remember in the second round of that meet, I was in a heat with Brandon McBride, and he had just won NCAA's indoor.
What year was this? This is like 15?
This was 14.
14, okay.
Yeah, and I was up against him, and I'm like, yo, he's the NCAA champion. And I remember, I think Elliot Rudo was in that race too. And so those are the only two guys in the country who had ran 145 that season. And I'm just like, wait, I'm in here with them. Like, bring it on, let's go. And unfortunately, I didn't make nationals that season. I missed it by like two places, but I still walked away with the PR. So still grateful for that.
Yeah, I kind of like you just maybe had the bad luck of a draw, because I'm pretty sure like that was like one of those Clayton Murphy seasons and that kind of stuff. And like it was just stacked in the 800.
Yeah, it was stacked. Mm-hmm.
Where did you want to take, I guess, like at that point, knowing that you hadn't made, well, I guess let's see, in your tweet, you said you only made NCAAs in the 800 once. What was that one time?
My 2015, my senior year indoors.
Okay.
And I finished ninth. So I was the first guy out of being in the final.
And so once this kind of like closes your collegiate career, what did you really want to keep this going, or like why?
Yeah, so like I love the sport in general, and I wasn't quite sure whether or not I wanted to continue and pursue it. For me, it was a matter of, all right, I know I'm faster than 148. I know what I've done in practice in college. I know I can run at least 147. It's just a matter of how do I find a coach? How do I go about this pro career? How do I do it? And then luckily at the time, District Track Club, they were first forming that year, and they reached out to me and said, hey, like we saw what you did during your career, and we think you'd be a good fit for our club. Would you like to join? And initially I was a little bit hesitant because they were more of like an 800, 1500 type of group. And in college and high school, I trained more 4.8, but our coach, Tom Brumlick, really worked with me, and he really plays. So he really works to your strengths and the best of your ability. So, of course, like there was some strength work, but he definitely incorporated some speed in there as well.
So you graduate and you decide to do graduate school at Towson, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What were you studying there?
I was doing IT and software engineering.
Oh, so this is like a good career that you've got in your back pocket aside from running.
Yeah.
What is it that you want to do? I guess like it once running, you know, takes a back burner. What is it you want to do with your career outside of running?
I guess in the short term, I would probably venture off into like software development and all that stuff. Eventually, I think I really want to like get into I want to find somewhere where I can fuse both running and fitness and technology and put that and make it my own. That's something I really want to do in the future.
So when you did eventually, I guess like find District Track Club, where did you kind of see yourself in the mix of the group that they had at that point? Like, did you find it an easy transition into like the pro life?
It was easy and hard at the same time. The reason why I felt it was somewhat easy because there were some people on the team who I ran against in college. And I kind of knew them already. There were two guys in with the Howard, but it was hard at the same time because there were some workouts that we did where I was like, man, I cannot keep up at all. Just like mainly like the longer reps, workouts that we did. And some of those workouts were just so intense and all that stuff. But when we did like the speed, the faster workouts, I definitely felt like myself and felt normal for the most part.
And then you competed at the 16 U.S. trials, 17 USAs out in Sacramento, and then shortly thereafter declared for to compete for Nigeria, right?
Mm-hmm.
What went into that process, and like, how did that come about?
Yeah, so I always kind of knew I could compete for Nigeria. I knew I could compete for Nigeria maybe about my junior, senior year of college. And so it was always something that was in the back of my mind. I decided to do the U.S. trials primarily because, number one, I wanted to just go for the experience and I wanted to hopefully set a PR, which I was able to do. And in 2017, I decided to do U.S. again just because I competed in the U.S. trials the year before. And so like maybe like a couple of days after U.S. trials, one of the people from the Nigerian Federation reached out to me saying, hey, like, would you like to compete for Nigeria at the London World Championships? And I was hesitant at first, but then I just thought to myself, like, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be in this sport, and I don't know how much, like, this opportunity isn't going to happen again. And so I just decided to make that switch and been running for Nigeria ever since.
It's funny because I guess like you went back over the weekend and also started like retweeting some of your old tweets, or one of them was you just said, I really wish I was faster, man, on August 3rd, 2015. What was going on in life back then? And like, I guess you did kind of go back and tell, like, if you could shake that version of yourself and talk to him, what would you say?
Man, I would just tell him, man, just relax. I think that summer of 2015, I was going through a lot, you know, just graduated from college, wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, whether I just wanted to work or to continue running. And I think at that moment, I kind of wish I was faster just because then I knew I would probably be still running for sure. And I probably would have gotten a brand sponsorship and all that stuff. And so that's probably what I was thinking at the time. But so what I would tell my younger self is just relax, just breathe, and just enjoy the process.
When you do get that world championship experience, you kind of make good on another previous tweet where I think you had like floated around the idea of what it'd be like to compete, you know, in London, in Tokyo, and then just wherever worlds or like the sport would take you. Uh-huh. That experience in London, what stood out to you the most?
That experience in London was phenomenal. I've never really ran an open 800 with a big crowd like that, and just seeing how much popular track is in Europe than it is in the US and how people just love track so much out there. It was definitely an experience for the ages. Like, I never seen an event where even in the morning session, the stadium was that packed full. And so running there just made me realize, like, dang, man, I belong here. And this is a really dope experience that I hope a lot of people get to experience as well.
How much are you still learning about the 800? Because I feel like when you go to a world championships, you pick up on things like you're up against the best in the world. You get to hear the way that their bodies respond to certain moves during races, or when people go and how they approach things. What have you picked up on from now having gone to two?
Man, what I've learned is people are really strong. Like, people can run fast, running 145 off of a slow pace. People can run, I don't know, people are just really strong, and people can really close very hard off of a slow pace. And that's something that I wasn't 100% used to, especially, like, I've negative split some fast times before, but seeing them do it with like no pacer and anything like that and just be able to go like that is something that I've picked up over the years, and just seeing that they're able to do that. And then just, I tend to people watch a lot when I'm warming up on the track, and even just when I'm before warming up and stuff like that. And just seeing, you know, how people move, what kind of drills they do, you know, just how they carry themselves. Because these are people I've been watching in Diamond League races and other past Olympics for a while. So seeing them in person, it's like, man, like, I'm trying to get like you. So let me see how you carry yourself and all that stuff.
Is it funny that one of the guys to watch super closely is 23 years old and runs for the United States and is just running like 143 like it's no one's business?
It's wild, man. Donovan is a different animal, man. He's definitely someone who's going to be very tough to beat. And me and my teammates, we always talk about, you know, how do we beat this guy, and like, can he be beat? Yeah, but he's insane for sure.
How do you visualize that, like, in practice and just doing, putting in the work, knowing this guy is, you know, it's a reach to in all honesty, like it's a reach to think like, all right, tomorrow I can easily get him at, you know, in 142 high or something like that. Right. But when you're in practice, how are you visualizing this?
When I'm in practice, I'm really just focusing on what I can control and what the effort I put in at practice. I don't really think about my competitors too much at practice. I really just try to run the rep that I'm in and just try to finish the workout strong, because usually, and some of our workouts lately, they've been rough. So, man, I just try to survive the workouts each day.
What's been the roughest one recently?
The roughest one recently, we had 6x300 and half of them were about 36. I threw up afterwards.
Yeah. That's how you know it's a good session. And sort of like when your group, because like I guess not a ton of people know of the District Track Club, but you guys are popping off some good times down in the DC area. Who's in the group and like what's the training balance like? Who's working out with who?
Yeah, so primarily the guys in our group is Alex Amankwa. He used to run for Alabama. He runs for Ghana as well. Carmel Prince, he runs for Guyana. We have Vincent Crisp, who just recently graduated from Texas Tech last year. We have John Lewis, who graduated from Clemson fairly recently as well. And then we have Jacob Dunford, who went to Notre Dame. And we have CJ Jones, who went to Texas Tech as well. And so primarily most of us all kind of train together, but we might branch off a little bit. But for example, me, Quamel, and Alex, really us three really do all the same workouts. Sometimes Vince and CJ will go a lot shorter, and John and Jacob will sometimes do longer stuff. And we also have Rob Heppenstall coming sometime soon whenever the borders open up, but yeah, he should be coming maybe in September or October, hopefully.
How's it been dealing sort of with the pandemic? Because when you're in a case where the process isn't anything like the trials, where I think it's just like a selection, right, for Nigeria?
Yeah, especially in the 800, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's not – you didn't have to go out and – well, aside from hit a qualifying time, there wasn't too much that you had to do. It's like your spot for Tokyo was kind of assured. How'd you handle the news that you have to wait a whole another year?
Man, see, this is the part that people don't know. In January, I actually suffered my first injury, so I missed the whole indoor season. I had posterior tendonitis in my left foot, and I couldn't run a step pretty much. And I had to just cross train for pretty much the whole month of January and half of February. And I also had to, for like the second half of February, I really had to just slowly transition back into actual running. So I started really slow. I even was training with the girls for like maybe a week. And so when the pandemic hit, I wasn't too upset. For me, it was like a blessing in disguise, because I looked at it as, all right, I have more time to get back right. Let me just focus on this process of getting back right 100%. And then hopefully I'll be able to drop some time and hopefully still get that standard.
I mean, so you had an injury back in January. The comeback process, I mean, you said it took some time. What was the lowest point of it? Like, was there a minute on, minute off run or something like that you had to do?
The lowest point of it for me was just not being able to run at all. The fact that, because that was my first injury ever. I've never been injured in this sport. And so when I got injured, it was just like, what is going on here? And so I remember I tried to force it, like one workout, I was like warming up and I was kind of like compensating and limping a little bit. And I was just like, yeah, this really hurts. And so I tried to like do a warm-up stride and it just wasn't going to happen. And that was a really low point for me, because I usually don't miss workouts and I never had to really sit out of a workout to just cross train. And when I had to do that, it was just like, dang, and like seeing my other teammates being able to run and do all these things and missing out on indoors, not racing at all, but seeing other people race, it's like, man, I hope that like this Tokyo thing doesn't slip away from me. But one thing that I did learn is that sometimes you have to just focus on your process and let go of the outcome, because we can't control the outcome at the end of the day. And it's like, yeah, we have all these goals and all these dreams, but you have to be willing to let go of that outcome and just focus on the actual process to get to that outcome.
It kind of makes the 144 time trial just a lot sweeter.
Yeah, it does, for real.
So 144, how did take us through what exactly happened? There's obviously no like live stream or anything like that of the race. How did it go down?
Right. So basically, we had a pacer and he took us through 51 mid, and so I was like 51.6, and then he ran to almost 600 meters, and so I really pressed that third 200 to really like stay on him. And then once he dropped out, it was just, all right, let's go balls to the wall and let's just hopefully finish something strong so I can run a decent time, and ended up being 144.8.
What's the reaction to that? I mean, was it like hand time? Did you have to like see it from someone's phone or something?
No. So we had the track that we train at, they host a lot of track meets. And okay. So coach was able to get like an electronic timer and everything. So that was an official FAT time 144. Granted, when I first crossed, my coach was hand timing it. So when he screamed out 144, I was kind of like, wait, let me see what this other coach has to say who was on the actual computer timing it. And then when he said 144 as well, I wanted to celebrate, but then I also knew like, wait, this is not an official race for real. So I was kind of like, I was really tired, but I also knew that, hey, this isn't an official race. So like, it doesn't really count for anything, but I was happy on the inside.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, it's to take it. I'm having it something similar too, where it's like I just happened to run somewhat of a mile PR recently, but I'm not ready to call it a PR until it happens in like a legit race.
Right.
But it's good to know sort of that's where your fitness is at, and for it to only be, I guess, early August at this point, you've still got, I guess, a couple more months of, I guess, this window that's open for qualifying. Well, not really for Olympic qualifying times, but for the, like, and it doesn't even matter for you, like the U.S. Olympic trials qualifying times, but the window's open. You've got like plenty of time. Where do you want to take this?
I just really,
are you ready to say like 143 or like 143 or no, not yet?
I mean, we're going to see. I really just want to be consistent running 144 and just really, I just want to be consistent. I don't want to be one of those guys where they just run 144 one time and they never run it ever again. I just really want to just focus on the process and focus on winning races and just being an overall better runner and better racer. And if 143 comes with that, I'm happy. And if another 144 comes with that, I'm happy as well. Or even if a couple 145 lows come with that, I'll be happy as well. So I just really want to be just an overall good racer, because I know being a good racer is going to take you so much further than just the time itself. And if you're a good racer, the time will take care of itself as well.
So is there like any indication of like when the next like real opportunity you're going to have to race?
Yeah. So I'm planning on competing at the Music City Distance Carnival in Nashville in about 2 weeks. And I'm hoping to run something fast there. I've run there, this was my fourth year running there, and I've run 145 each year. So hopefully maybe get a 144 again this time, and we'll see what happens from there.
What's all the extra stuff you have to do now, I guess, in order to go to a race like that? Do you need, like, what are the rules so far? Like, 2 COVID tests, like, in the week, or what are you looking at?
Yeah, something like that. I know, I believe we have to do 2 COVID tests, and, yeah, we have to do 2 COVID tests. I'm scheduled, I have one on Saturday. It's one of my first time, so I'm a little bit nervous, but I'm hoping to have another one maybe early the following week as well.
For sure. All right, I'm going to hit you with the final questions that I ask every guest. So the first one is, what's the funniest drug testing story that you have?
Oh, my gosh. All right, this one is hilarious. So it's the only one I have. So basically, I was in testing pool maybe about a couple years ago, and I remember this usually is like a 3-month window, right? 3-month period. And they caught me on the tail end of that period. And so I kind of forgot that they were coming. And it was like 6:45 in the morning, and someone's knocking on the door, and then I'm sleeping, and then I think my brother's about to go to work, and then he's knocking on the door. I mean, he's looking at the door, and he sees it's some random dude, so he didn't want to open the door. And so then this kind of wakes me up because he's not leaving. And so then I go to the bathroom just in general because, you know, that's what you do when you first wake up. And so then they finally open the door, and then it's the guy looking for me for the drug test. And I'm just like, wait, I just went to the bathroom. So we legit had to wait for like 2 hours for me to pee again. And it was hilarious. I think I tried to pee before,
You were just sitting there? Nothing
came out. And so, like, mind you, they have to watch when you pee. So it's just like, yeah, this is, it got a little awkward. And then so then eventually I was finally able to pee. So yeah, that was the funny drug test story that I had.
What's the meanest thing that you've read about yourself on letsrun.com? Is there much on there?
It's funny. I don't really read too much on Let's Run, but actually if someone showed me a Let's Run article about me running 144, and someone found out that I ran for Nigeria, and then someone said, oh, he sold his soul or whatever to run. And I was just like, all right, whatever. Like, so that's probably the meanest thing that I saw.
Just got to brush it off. All right. Yeah. If you could go on a run anywhere in the world with anyone from history, they don't have to be real. You can hold a nice conversational pace with you. Where would the run take place and who would it be with?
It would be in Monaco, just because that's like one of the dream places I want to go to, and hopefully one day I'll compete at their Diamond League. And then in terms of who I would want to run with, let me see. Do they have to be a runner or?
No, they don't have to be a runner. Some of the better answers are not runners.
Oh, I'd probably run with Kobe. Rest in peace, but I'd probably run with Kobe Bryant.
What was your reaction? Where were you? Because that's one, I guess, like one of those big things, especially this year. And I was talking about this actually just a couple of days ago with a friend of mine. It's like we've had multiple moments, at least this year, where it's like, where were you when? And so where were you when you found out Kobe Bryant died?
I was at the gym cross training when I found out. I was just like, and the thing is, I was injured at that time. And so when I found out, I was just like, wait, what? I was in a group chat and one person texted me, like, man, my favorite basketball player just died. And I was just like, oh, who's that? And he was like, Kobe. And I was like, wait, what? Kobe? And then they started showing it like on the TV and stuff like that. And I was just devastated because that was definitely my favorite basketball player growing up.
Yeah. I mean, it was just crazy. I was working that day, and it's sort of one of those things where TMZ was like the first person to break that news. And so half the time you're just like, all right, well, it's TMZ. Like, they've killed Lil Wayne like four times already. And so it's like, I don't know if I could trust it. But then you realize, no, this is TMZ in LA. And like, they have their sources, they have their people ingrained in there. So it was like, yeah, this is pretty reliable. And so, yeah, that news was heavy. And then I guess just the days to follow with all the tributes and all that were crazy. Definitely one of the worst days of this year, and there have been many rough days of this year. All right, final question has nothing to do with track. It's got basketball thrown in here. It's you get 25 shots from half court. If you make one, you win $25 million. If you don't make any, you go to jail for 25 years. Would you attempt the shots?
No, I'm trash at basketball.
No. That's a smart answer, because I don't think, yeah, $25 million is not my price of freedom, at least.
Yeah, not at all. Can't get that time back.
Yeah, exactly. All right, man. Well, I appreciate you taking the time for this. This is a lot of fun, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to be excited to get to know you a little bit better. And, yeah, I mean, you've got us on our toes with these tweets. These tweet threads are inspiring a bunch of people now.
Yeah, man, I appreciate that. Thank you so much for having me on.
Of course. That's all for this episode of the show. Many thanks to Eidos for the chat. If you listened to and enjoyed this episode, give us a shout out on your Instagram stories. We'll repost it to all our followers, and that helps new people discover the show. Very quickly, I'm now doing a weekly newsletter where you can get your fix of all the news in the running community, as well as analysis and commentary from yours truly. Stay up to date. It takes 1 minute to sign up on Substack. The link is included in the show notes, so I look forward to dropping that email in your inbox every Friday. I will be in Boulder, Colorado for most of August, so if you're out there or know of some cool running spots or places to hang, feel free to reach out. This is my first time visiting, and I definitely want to make the most of the trip. Hit me up, Twitter, at Chris Chavez, Instagram, Chris_J_Chavez, email me, Chris@sidiousmag.com. Many thanks to Gooder for sponsoring the show. Show some love for the sponsors and pick up a pair of the most affordable performance sunglasses. They're only $25 and come in great styles. Visit Gooder.com/Sidious. That's Goodr.com/Sidious to see some of my favorite lenses and styles. I've been your host, Chris Chavez, wishing you some happy and healthy running. Legs are feeling good. Eyes are looking gooder.